coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 28 of The Curious Realm. Does not seem like we are, God, like 80 hours of content into the rebrand of this show, but I am here to tell you folks, the audience has more than five times since we have rebranded. It is obvious that that was the thing to do. That is what we needed to do in order to reach the larger audience and get out there. It's been fantastic. Over 5,500 followers on the Facebook right now and over 1,000 members of the group. So stop on by, join us, join the conversation. While you're there, stop on by jarofpaint.com. That is the website of our amazing guest, Jason McLean. We will be talking with him here in just a few minutes about cryptids, cryptozoology, cryptids in Texas, cryptids in the Bible, all kinds of stuff. We're going to be having a great time with him. We had a chance to meet him at the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Roadshow put on by Southeast Texas Bigfoot out in Mineola about a month or so ago. It was super fun. Please do not forget, coming up June 18th, we will be live broadcasting from the Falk Monster Festival. Our good friend Craig Woolheater is putting that on. We will be out there to talk with him. So many other presenters, guests, things like that. Daniel Allen Jones will be there. All kinds of fun stuff. If you can, stop on out. Visit us live. See us out on site. Always great getting out in the thick of it, getting out in the meat of the communities and really seeing what it's all about, because these communities of cryptozoology, paranormal, ufology, they cursorily touch in so many ways, but they are so, the depths of them go so far on their own. It's absolutely amazing. We will be getting to our good friend Jason McLean here in just a second. Right after our news of the week, of course, brought to you by our Facebook group. Stop on by, join the conversation. Facebook, just look up Curious Realm. Out of insider.com, a Florida man died while searching for frisbees in a gator infested lake. Here's why people risk life and limb looking for the discs. Absolutely. I know quite a few disc golfers, myself included, that has waded out in water. Can't say it's ever been gator infested water, but out of the sun.co.uk, UFO flew over U.S. warship faster than any known craft in sighting by 200-man crew. Oh, yes, folks. Out of gizmodo.com, behold the first trailer for Paramount's Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe. Beavis and Butthead are coming back in an amazing new movie. And out of newsbreak.com, Kentucky Democrat wears noose in new ad attacking Rand Paul. That is just some of the news this week there on the group. Stop on by, join the conversation. While you are there, make sure to stop on by the website of our guest, jarofpaint.com. Our guest, Jason McLean, he is the author of Metroplex Monsters. He is also the host of Ciro Papers. He is also the host of Texas Front Porch. That is Texas, like T-E-X apostrophe S, like the possessive Front Porch. So stop on by, check him out. Welcome to the show again. Jason, how are you doing?
Doing really, really well, Chris. I'm actually still vibing from the intro. It's like a late 90s, you know, sort of techno feel. You know, you're just kind of in the club and... You know, it's like It's slower than usual techno, so it's like the, okay. so it's like partner dance. It's like, hey, it's time for the slow skate for
I
all you lovers out
that.
There.
A lot of people ask me how I achieved the 90s and 80s vibe with a lot of my music, and it's like I mainly use 90s and 80s gear. That is the trick. You see, is to actually use beat machines from the time. But that's also
sense.
Just because I've had them for years and I refuse to buy new things. I'm not in the box liver, as it's called, with music. As most people can see over my shoulders, I'm patch bays. I'm analog. Like I'm forced and crowbarred into the world of digital with my music.
I got you.
And I've gotten there, but I still don't enjoy swimming in the water. You know, it's like, I'll go to the creek. I'll take some sips. I'll put my feet in because, yeah, everybody's going to the creek. But, you know.
Yeah. You're not swimming in the gator infested water for some digital frisbees, huh?
Oh, no. I will totally throw $20 down on another frisbee.
I've got no
problems.
It's like I kind of felt bad laughing at that headline, but I'm like, you knew that they were in there when you went. Seriously.
There are normally really big signs, and you're in Florida, so if there's water, there's probably one.
It's like there's a point where you're like, okay, come on. They're like, it's like Texas. I know what I'm getting into. It's like, nope, rattlesnake. Mm-hmm. Nope, water moccasin.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Not happening.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I get it. Although, speaking of rebranding, I know you mentioned rebranding. So Jar of Paint may not be the best place to find me right now. We're actually getting ready to do some redos on that as well. Sirupapers.com, SIRUpapers.com, right now has all the best links for me. If you want to find me on Texas Front Porch, you want to find me on the Siru Papers YouTube channel, all
Copy
of it,
that.
All my books, everything. It's SIRUpapers.com. That's everything. Eventually, Jar of Paint will... It will be updated. I'm actually working on a comic strip, but it's going to be not animated, but I'll be doing voiceovers for it. It's going to be designed for like TikTok and YouTube shorts and that kind of thing. So we're doing some work on it. So eventually it will come back. But for now, Sirupapers, SIRUpapers.com is the place to find me.
Well, and with that in mind, let's get into Siru Papers just a little bit. Tell our audience what it is all about, because I had heard of Siru Papers and seen it around in various communities. Of course, like Daniel Allen Jones, Craig Woolheater, we all tend to revolve around the same communities, and eventually we meet. I had seen the Siru Papers, and once I met you, started diving into it a little bit. Tell our audience what it is all about.
So it started years ago. Actually, I originally had created as sort of an online story that I was working on, and then eventually I decided to make it a real thing. And the idea is this: it's a society for the research and investigation of the unknown. And what we do is we look at the world from a biblical worldview and say, okay, there's obviously disagreements on certain topics and certain things. It's fine, but there are general themes that everyone's kind of agrees with and just says, okay, let's look at all the data, right? I don't want cherry-picked data. I want all the data. Give me all the evidence. Give me all the arguments. And then we look at it and say, okay, well, what does this look like? Because at the end of the day, I spent years and years trying to figure out, what do I actually think? What do I believe? And the simple fact of the matter is, when you look at all the data, all the accounts, I would argue the world just makes way more sense, again, from an overall narrative perspective. If you take a look at the Bible, the narrative that's in the Bible, you can throw the dates out if you want, just basic ideas, basic concepts, because, again, those are whole arguments unto themselves. You could do three episodes on whether or not Genesis is overall supposed to be literal. Should it be, what's metaphorical? Like, let's put all that to the side. Basic story is this: there's a God who created the universe. There's supernatural beings under him. They have responsibilities. They interact with us. He creates a perfect world, meaning optimal, right? For longevity of life. things did not go according to plan, partly our fault, partly some of these other supernatural beings.
Are we sure about that, though?
Well, it looks like I'm just looking around the world. I'm like, you know what? I don't think we need all that much help being bad, but it does look like there's definitely some interaction.
Sure.
God pushes a reset button. And now what we have is what's came through all that.
Yeah.
We still have these other beings. We still have these other things, but it's like, okay, if that's the narrative, then we should find other themes in the modern world that match up with that. We find, again, archaeologically speaking, we find all kinds of animals that look just like the ones today. They're just massive, right? The glyptodon is an armadillo the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. Territorn, a condor the size of a bus. Alligators used to be crocodilians.
Giant sloths. Longer.
Giant sloths, exactly. And then, of course, you have the other things. You've got, dinosaurs. You have all these other things. Like, everything was bigger. It was more robust. It was more diverse than necessarily what we see today. So it does match up. And when you get into the paranormal aspect, a lot of this matches up with the themes and context that we see. So that's the perspective that we're coming from. And so we try to put everything within that context. Like, hey, because ultimately, let's face it, I'm a big fan of water cryptids, right? Love them to death. They're my favorite thing. But it's like, okay, so let's say that, let's say we can wave a magic wand and boom, Champy, right? The Lake Champlain monster.
Yeah.
So we find it. We know what it is. Whole nine yards. Great. Okay. Well, then what? Like, it's like, all it is just another piece of the puzzle. For me, the paranormal and cryptids, forbidden archaeology, all these things, and yes, ufology included, are just pieces to a larger puzzle. I'm not overly concerned with what these things end up being once we can kind of figure out what they are.
Yeah.
My concern is that we put them in the puzzle so we can see what the world really is. Because I think a lot of us agree that the overall narrative that we're told in the mainstream is not just in error. It is deliberately in error. That there are plenty of people who probably believe it wholeheartedly. Absolutely. But if the more you look, the more you realize there are a lot of people who are going out of their way to manipulate the data to conform to a narrative that is advantageous to political power structures of certain businesses, things like that. So there's definitely a narrative that we're being told, and that anything that fits outside that box is shunned.
Yeah,
because there is this narrative that the world is running on right now. And these things are narratives that are the evidence that narrative is incorrect. I just want to know what the real story is. I want to know what the truth is. I want to know what the correct narrative is. And so that's what Siri is about. It's people coming together to just, I want all of the data so we can make the best decision possible. We can live our best lives, because I believe that ultimately us as the individual, we are the things that history turns on. It isn't necessarily large empires. It's us. It's the individual. It's the one person who stands up when everyone else is told to sit down.
Yeah.
We have the power to change the world. The current narrative says you're powerless, you're meaningless. I would argue that is exactly opposite of the truth. I think we are powerful and
Absolutely.
We are exceptionally meaningful.
Yeah. And, the example that I make regularly on this show is Magellan.
Yeah.
That's quite literally what I consider researchers of your ilk and the people that we talk to, because you have taken the evidence at hand and you are willing to forge forth on a different course than everybody else with the same evidence at hand. Everybody else was willing to go like, I'll go a little bit past like Cape Horn. But after that, like, world ends, man. I'm going to fall off of it. Magellan's like, well, with the same info, why not? Let's see what happens.
Exactly.
You literally have to be willing to take the same set of data and apply it in a different way. You don't even need a different data set. You can use the exact same data set. It's just the filter with which you're looking at it. And I mean, a prime example, here recently, just in the last year. This is stuff that has happened within the last year while we were locked down, Jason. We found Dragon Man.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a hoax. That was an actual real thing with a skull, with a human skull, with the volume almost twice that of an average human, you know, dating back to 146,000 years ago, way before when we thought or ever said that humans as we know it are there, just out of Science Daily in the last couple days. This was June 1st. Studies suggest that most of our evolutionary trees could be wrong. That's a study out of University of Bath, you know, and that's literally looking at the exact same data sets with a different filter. They are not looking at, now granted, the Dragon Man, yes, totally new data set, totally new info. However, there had been the Hobbits a few years ago. There's the ongoing question as to whether or not the Hobbits are still there.
As the orangutan deck,
or even just as a Hobbit people, like we found over 500 just over 500 new species last year while the world was in lockdown. There's typically about 1,000 found per year, so like we mentioned last time you were on, it's a bit haughty of us to look at all of it and say absolutely not. Go ahead.
A great example of what you're talking about is actually the Torosaurus, right?
Mm.
When we were all growing up, and really up until very, very recently, I mean, I think it's within the last 10 years. I'm getting old now, so I don't even know when things happen anymore. But like, we were all, it's like you put, open any dinosaur book, right? There's a Triceratops, then there's this Torosaurus, and it's its own species. And the Torosaurus was just, it had a much larger crest. It had these two openings in the crest. That was it. That's what it was. We had these two radically different species.
Yeah.
And then someone, I can't remember exactly who off the top of my head, he comes around and says, hey, you know what? We've got a lot of information now on we've found a lot of these things. And these Torosaurs seem like a very, very small population. They're scattered around. They do seem related to, you know, connected to the Triceratops. And then they start taking a closer look at some of these Triceratops frills. They start noticing the larger the frill got for a Triceratops, some areas started thinning out. And what's happened is that we now realize the Torosaurus is not a Torosaurus. It's a Triceratops. It's just the bull male of the Triceratops family. That's all it was.
Ah.
So, again, to your point, people looking at the exact same data set for decades said, different species, is a different thing altogether. And now all of a sudden it's like, nope, same data set, same information, but someone thought about it a different way and said, no, these things are actually the bull males. And it makes a lot more sense of the data that we have. And things like this are happening. Jack Warner is really big on revolutionizing this thought because we have all these species. And one of the things he pointed out, and I've actually thought about this for honestly, since the 90s, it's like we seem to have a lot of infants and we have a lot of adults. We don't seem to have juveniles of these species. Why?
Yeah.
And so his basic premise was maybe a lot of these species are nothing more than juvenile versions of the same, of another species, right? And so because everyone wants to have a species, they want to name the species, right? They want to be the one who discovers the species. And they don't really want to do things like destroy a leg bone by cutting it open and counting the growth rings in it, things like that. So there's a lot of, so just going back to your point, there's so much information out there. Sometimes just take someone to ask a question a different way to make better sense of what we're looking at.
Yeah, precisely. And to be willing to examine it with different eyes. You know, a prime example is, and we just talked about it this last week with our last guests, the makers of the new Bigfoot documentary. The Patterson-Gimlin film. That is one that to this day stands scrutiny scrutiny to the fact of like, yes, when new pixel by pixel techniques come out, they are applied to it, and it still stands up as authentic. Yes. It has yet to be proven to be any kind of fakery, to be any kind of costume, to be any film fakery or tricks or special effects or anything like that. It has never been proven to be anything but genuine.
Exactly. And it's an amazing world out there. And to your point, every time some new piece of technology or some new expert in film or special effects or mask making or all of these things, they come together like, hey, we're looking at this and there's no part of this that seems fake, because there's, you know, like, these are things we look for, we don't find them. At a certain point, you know, it's amazing to see that we're still trying to, let me rephrase it this way. The truth will always withstand scrutiny.
Yes.
The things that don't withstand scrutiny are the things they don't, or the things they will not allow you to ask questions about.
Hmm. Now, with that in mind, Jason, what was it that first sent you down the road of asking these questions? Because some of these questions that you bring up in Ciru papers, things like that, as well as the things that you bring up in Metroplex Monsters, are not necessarily questions that a lot of people enjoy courting or are willing to court. So what was it that first brought you to the point of question and, I guess, got you digging the rabbit hole that you are currently a part of, as we all are?
That's a great question. For me, probably, I wouldn't have even said this up until very, very recently. When I was 12, I had an encounter, 11, 12. I had an encounter with a living pterosaur just outside of Dallas, Texas, in DeSoto. It's literally a suburb of Dallas. And I myself didn't believe what I saw for 20 years, even though during this entire period, and even as I got older, I believed there were still living dinosaurs. I believed that there were pterosaurs in Texas. But my problem was this. All the things I had seen was like Brownsville, hundreds of miles south. The Rio Grande Valley, you know, this is, you know, these are hundreds of miles away. I could not believe that there was a population of living pterosaurs in and about a suburb of Dallas, Texas, right? It did not compute in my brain. I thought people would have talked about it more. And so it wasn't until, you know, and I think ultimately that kind of got me into these things. I was always sort of raised in this, right? My father said, you can believe whatever you want to believe. Just make the argument as to why you believe it.
Sure. Be willing to question yourself and your own motives.
Exactly. It's like, hey, at the end of the day, you know, when you stand, it's going to be just you alone in the dark. You should be able to honestly say to yourself, I did the best I could with what I had, and I made the best decisions with what I have. And I genuinely believe, I think this is also one of those things we don't believe. We instinctively know, but we don't ever verbalize it. You can't make good decisions if you don't have good information. So
yeah.
For me, I think, you know, it seems almost strange at first to say, well, what does Bigfoot and living dinosaurs have to do with making good decisions about the world we live in, about the lives we lead? But for me, I go back to it's these are pieces of the larger narrative. If you understand what the universe actually is, how the world actually works, then you can make better decisions. Again, if you're told every day that you are powerless and meaningless, you will live out your life that way. And I think we have seen plenty of people who make tragic decisions based off of that idea.
All too sadly.
They are powerless and meaningless. But if we realized that we were powerful and that our lives had meaning, we would change how we would live. And if we realized that every other person was both powerful and meaningful, we would treat other people differently. And we would make different decisions. But So that's why I think that's why I ultimately kind of went this way. It was, you know, I had an encounter I couldn't even believe, and I didn't tell anybody about for 20 years. And yet during that time frame, I fell more and more into researching these things and looking into these things because I did want to know what's the shape of the world, really. I don't mean that literally, I mean that metaphorically. You know, and it's like I want to make the best decisions in my life. I want to understand why we're here, where we're going, what are we doing. And so it just one thing kind of ultimately led to the other. And I personally hate it when people say you can't ask a question. Whenever I hear, don't talk about that or don't ask that question, that's the first thing. Like my brain's like, oh, well, guess what we're going to talk about right now? You know, because I don't believe the truth needs to be protected. Truth will need to be defended, yes, but truth will never be, because ultimately, as we found, you know, the truth will speak for itself, but we have to speak that truth. But it doesn't need to be, the truth doesn't need to be protected. It should be examined. It should be looked at, and it should be looked at with new technology, new perspectives, new ideas every single time. That's the only way we grow as a species. It's the only way we grow as people.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, that one event, I think, started a much larger chain reaction it's that past event that has led us to today.
Yeah. And it's so often there is that stealing moment in life, that one moment that was like, okay, well, if I can do something, it's going to be this.
Yep.
And good on you for following that instinct, for carrying on that tradition that your dad taught you, believe what you want, but be willing to question it. When your experience happened to you, like you said, Jason, you didn't share your experience right off with people.
Oh, no, not my father would have believed me too. Mm. And yet I didn't even tell him.
Why do you think that is?
Because I couldn't believe it. Because again, you're a kid. I had that naive thought that I think we all have at some point, where it's like, well, if these things were real, people would talk about them.
Sure.
And that's just not the case. In fact, the one thing I found, honestly, really when I was doing research for the book, is I'm really convinced now that the majority of people have had some kind of spectacular encounter. Doesn't necessarily have to be, cryptid or anything like that. But I think the majority of people have had some kind of unexplainable, I don't even like the phrase unexplainable, because I think they are explainable, which is actually I've talked about. Let me rephrase it this way. I think most people have had encounters with what the mainstream narrative has told us is impossible. And they don't say anything because they're worried about what will happen to them if they come forward. They don't want to be that weird person that saw a pterosaur or saw some, you know, or saw a Bigfoot or saw a UFO or saw whatever, right? They don't want to be the person who asks for help with a shadow person because they have sleep paralysis and these things are coming into their room. They don't want to have to have the uncomfortable conversation and have people look at them and they're like, hey, my family is seeing things with backwards facing legs coming into our home at night or standing outside our windows with red glowing eyes. Like, they don't want to be the ones to have that conversation because we are almost instinctively programmed to believe that that's not possible. And so we think we're the only ones that have these encounters. And when you think that, you don't want to break that cone of silence, right? Because you're worried that people will do what they do, right? Like the kid who was attacked by the giant, condor, theoretically, back in the 70s.
Yeah.
I forget his name off the top of my head. But once it became publicized what had happened, this kid was attacked by this giant condor-looking creature in front of numerous witnesses. He was torn up. So there's this visual
proof. Yeah, dragged across his
lawn. Exactly. In front of eyewitnesses, and once it comes out, people start tormenting him. He becomes the bird boy. People start leaving dead birds at on his front porch. Like, what kind of nonsense is that?
Yeah.
where it's like, we got it. It's like, hold on. This kid was savagely attacked by some possibly, you know, some impossibly large bird. Quick, let's make fun of him. Like, what goes on in your head? Well, ultimately, I think what's going on is that the people around them, they're trying, humans are pack animals,
yeah.
Right? We in anything that causes the main, that narrative that we feel that we're a part of, anything that runs afoul of that idea, we reject and we attack it because ultimately what we're attacking is the belief that our understanding of the universe is wrong. This is why people respond so dramatically with these things. You can take it to politics, you can take it to religion, you can take it to whatever you want. The reason people lash out is they want to be comfortable thinking they know how the world is, whatever that perspective may be. And when someone comes around and says, hey, here's a piece that doesn't fit your worldview. Well, the problem is they instinctively understand that means their worldview has a flaw. And if it has a flaw, ultimately what that means if you follow that chain of thought, perhaps their entire, all the decisions they made, the beliefs about themselves, the beliefs about the people they know, the beliefs of how they believe the world is, it's all called into question. People instinctively lash out at that because they can't accept it. Because it does call a lot of things into their lives in question. I go back to, if you live your entire life believing that you are powerless and meaningless, it's going to lead you to make certain choices. And unfortunately, I think a lot of us have had this in our own lives. Sometimes the familiar pain is preferable to an uncomfortable joy or an uncomfortable sense of freedom. We see this in the story of the Exodus, right? They're free. The Hebrew people and the people who came with them, they're freed to live their lives. And yet as they're traveling, they start talking about going back.
Yeah.
They want to return to that slavery. And we see that in our own personal lives.
Wasn't it easier like that?
Yeah.
Like you're told what to do. We got food.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Well, how many people have gone back to bad relationships because that pain is familiar?
Oh, absolutely.
There's some degree of comfort in the familiar, or even because oftentimes with when there's some form of abuse, there's some form of someone's telling you what to do. You don't have that uncomfortable feeling of freedom. Freedom is a very difficult thing to have, and unfortunately, to face the truth head on, you have to be free to do that. And that is, and so again, the problem is with all of these things, people don't talk about what's happening because they don't want to be the person that says, hey, the world isn't what you think it is, because they understand what's the backlash is going to come at them.
Yeah. Yeah. And the backlash can be harsh, much, much like anybody coming out with an experience. You know, mm-hmm. And that is something that we have spent the last couple months really digging into with near-death experiences, being psychic, paranormal experiences with Bigfoot, UFO, UAP, abduction experiences. Like, everybody thinks that having an experience like that is a rosy lens moment in your life.
Yeah.
And probably about a good 70% of the time, you will hear the words, I was frozen in fear. I was frozen and I had no idea how I was feeling.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we as a society, as humanity, we get caught up on these definitions. And we forget that paranormal is just that. It's something that's not happening to you every day. That's all.
Exactly.
Like, you do not have to dig further. Something happened to this person that does not happen every day. So let's start there. and let's start with being willing to listen to the story of what doesn't happen every day. Because without being willing to listen, and that willingness, It's having the conversation, Jason, and being willing to not just wait your turn to speak, but to fully understand why somebody believes something and not care to change their belief system. And I think that's where a lot of people's cutoff is that they think for some reason that they have to actively change a belief system in a conversation, or that they have to help somebody redefine themselves with the conversation just to understand them as a person. And that's not necessarily the case.
No, it's not. And the thing is, I mean, even in our own lives, you know, we tend to forget. It's like, look, not every conversation needs to be some, you know, or some new piece of information doesn't have to radically shape your worldview into something unrecognizable. What it is just more information. And so what, as a culture, we need to be able to start doing is accepting. Let's get all the data. Let's compare the data. Let's look at the data. And then let's come, then we can start, we can decide, do we need to change our minds about things? Right? I think like all of us on this particular journey, I've changed my mind about a lot of things.
Sure.
3 or 4 or 5 times on any one given subject, because there's not a lot of objective data. And there's the objective data that's there is great. But there's a lot of subjective data, and you're trying to, and oftentimes they don't always match up. And so you have to try and make sense of these things. Well, let's just get all the data on the table. And of course, the problem is sometimes groups that are supposed to be in, you know, studying or researching a particular phenomena, you realize they're not giving, they themselves aren't giving you information that doesn't fit their paradigm.
Yeah.
And it's, and so it leads to a lot of confusion, a lot of arguments, and it's like, but that means we're not getting closer to the actual truth. In fact, by doing that, we're avoiding it. Let's be honest. If pick any phenomena you want. If it was easy, if it was simple, if it was obvious, we'd have already had the answers by now.
Yep.
It's not simple. It's not obvious. So we do need to look harder. We do need to be open for information. In particular, that data that does not fit nicely within our own worldview.
Yeah, we have to be willing when having that conversation to allow our paradigm to change and allow new, and really to begin looking at data as just that. It is data. It's a point of datum, nothing more. There are numerous like it. There are numerous not like it. So yeah, to literally, I think that's part of the problem is that people get so passionate about the data that is there that unfortunately confirmation bias can come back and rule the day.
Confirmation bias and denial. It's easy to point to, to those of us who are looking into these, you know, fringe ideas, you know, it's easy to point to us, but it's also, it's like, look, these are things that are, that confront every scientist.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's like, I'm sorry, the history of science is full of all of these ideas that were propagated for decades.
Yep.
Even though the people who came up with these ideas had data that told them they were wrong, but because they had become famous, they had made money off of these ideas, they suppressed this other information because they had their own biases, right? They had their own desires, you know, for whatever whatever's the motivating factor for that one individual. I'm sorry, this is people talk about pseudoscience. I'm like, okay, so you mean like, oh, you mean every other scientific endeavor that has ever occurred in the history of man? That's when people talk. Yeah. I love when they start, people use the word pseudoscience. I'm like, well, however you want to define that, is you're probably not going to like the way that turns out. Because I'm sorry, the history of science is the history of people doing pretty screwed up things to support their particular scientific theorem.
Yeah.
And it's because as humans, we have that bias. And part of it is admitting what your bias is and then seeking out that information that actually conflicts with you. What runs afoul of your worldview? And then examine that information. Again, sometimes the information doesn't hold up, but sometimes it does. And then it gives you another piece to re-examine and to start putting these pieces together.
Absolutely. And that's just it. We on the show regularly talk about, we don't say conspiracy theory. It's hypothesis, because you're allowed to hypothesize anything. It's through experimentation that you prove or disprove a hypothesis into theory. So,
well, exactly. No, precisely. And what's worse, don't even get me started on the entire, the origin of the word conspiracy theory.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like my favorite meme right now is just that guy standing out to a field is like me out here looking for new conspiracy theories because all mine turned out to be true.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's like really the history of at least the last 60, really post-World War I, but definitely post-World War II, is a time period of easily the largest political and, political psyop in human history.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to derail the entire conversation with this, but the two ideas, honestly, that are the absolute stronghold of this is the word conspiracy theory and the idea of the slippery slope fallacy. Like those two things have done more to completely undermine everything. And it's just, ultimately we here exist because it's not a conspiracy theory. You're just simply observing the universe around us, and we're trying to come to hypotheses, and those hypotheses have to be tested. Sometimes parts of them work. Sometimes parts of them don't work.
That's
sometimes
right.
They fall flat entirely. But, we have to, as humans, we have to experiment. Science is about experimentation. You make a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, and then you move on.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And to test a hypothesis, we're going to take a quick break real quick. And when we come back, we're going to swing the conversation over to the world of cryptozoology, not only through history, but in the Bible. What is the reason for these things being, I guess, not necessarily buried because they're in the Bible, but not really focused on? Much like we're talking about right now. So when we get back from break, we will take on those topics with Jason McLean, author of Metroplex Monsters, as well as host of the Siru Papers. We will be back with him right after this, folks. Stay tuned. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. The Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. All right, and welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much to our sponsors. Of course, those of you who are out there all the time know, stop on by. The secret of everything, secrettoeverything.com is the website. Our amazing sponsor, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge, she is your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion exercises. Stop on by, check her out today, secrettoeverything.com, as well as our great friends, WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is your source for high-speed internet for all, no data limits, no throttling, no credit checks, and no contracts. I'm here to tell you folks, Curious Realm, since we have been on the road, have been benchmarking this system for them, putting up almost 20 gigs of content a month with, yes, truth, no throttling. We have been out there live streaming everything. Thank you so much to WebWorks Wireless for providing that system for all of our live streams from great events like the upcoming Falk Monster Festival. Come on by, check us out June 18th in Falk, Arkansas. We will be there in person, or you can, of course, stop on by curiousrealm.com/live. While you're online, make sure to stop on by the website of our amazing guest, Jason McLean, the Ciru Papers, cirupapers.com. Jason, welcome back from commercial break. Let's start getting into biblical cryptozoology and cryptozoology throughout history, because, and now granted, that would include giants, that would include all kinds of things. So let's go ahead and start breaking down some of the instances in biblical history where cryptozoology is present.
Well, I'm first of all, I'm happy to be back. It was a lovely break. As far as, you know, that's a great question. I love how you asked it. Let me tweak it just a hair.
Okay.
The reason cryptozoology exists as an entire endeavor into itself is because it's pursuing things that the modern world has rejected because they run afoul our modern sensibilities, right? Our modern narratives about the way the world works. And it's interesting because you go back even 100, really even just 100 years. You don't even have to go back like 200, 300, 500 years. Even just 100 years ago, there were people who were writing about even some of these creatures that are described in the Bible, and they were taking them seriously. You go back 200, 400, 500 years ago, there was no cryptozoology. It was just whatever. It was really naturalism or it was just basic zoology. Like, these were things, they understood these things were real. There was a book, I'm trying to remember if it was even just a dictionary, from like the very early 1800s or late 1700s, that under the word dragon, right, it described what the dragons were, and even had a phrase, they are exceptionally rare in this time frame, but they had become rare. And so when we talk, I think, first of all, one of the reasons the Bible doesn't, like, why doesn't the Bible go into a lot of this detail about these things? Because they weren't necessarily odd at the time. They were accepted. People knew what these things were because people talked about them. They were part of their world. I think, a couple of things we're talking about were definitely rare by the time of the writing, but they were understood to be real. So it's like, I wouldn't, if I was, telling a story, I wouldn't go into detail about what a dog is because we know what a dog is, or a rhinoceros, we know what a rhinoceros is. For them, these creatures were normal. They were, well, not normal. They were, but they existed. They understood them. There was no need to go into detail on them, right? Obviously, if we kind of want to work through, sort of, I guess, from beginning to end. Really, there's four. I may even be miscounting it off the top of my head. I'm terrible with numbers. But you got the Nephilim, right? Those are the giants. Those are the first things that really sort of pop up by name. You've got Leviathan, and you've got Behemoth in Job, and we can go into more detail on this later, but the Behemoth, or the Leviathan in Job, is different from the Leviathan of Isaiah and Psalms, and that's a whole other kettle of fish. But you've got Leviathan, you have Behemoth, then you have the Isaiah's fiery flying serpents. There's one animal that's mentioned in Genesis that, depending on some views, maybe something more exotic, but I'm not sold on it. And this is, of course, removing things like the satyrs that are mentioned, right? Because those, like you'll find that in the 1611, it's an accurate translation. In fact, it's more accurate than what you find in a lot of modern Bibles that just call them donkeys. That's, or wild asses. That's not what, like, the Hebrew and the Greek is very, very specific about what that is. It is something like a satyr, but in context, it's because they're referring to them as demons, right? So, and even a lot of the dragon language that we see in the Bible is actually, it's there, and it's an accurate translation from, like, the Greek or the Latin, but they're in, it's being used as a code word for demon, right? That's the best way to look at them. So really, there's only four specific, what we would call, cryptids. We've got the giants. We've got Leviathan, which I would argue is something akin to a mosasaur. We have Behemoth, which is, I would argue, a sauropod. Then we have Isaiah's fiery flying serpents, which I would argue are pterosaurs that have been seen all throughout history and may even be related, a similar species to what I encountered in just outside of Dallas.
Interesting. And, once again, the idea of these stories, much like Sasquatch, anything like that, like you said, would not have been rarefied amongst the local populace. It would have been stories that they told regularly, things like that. Whether or not you choose to see the the Bible and the telling of the Bible as the collection of stories or as the delineated total divine word of God. I think it's important to realize that, yes, either way, this is the way that the local populace saw it.
Right. In fact, I would argue I would even argue that both of those ways you present them are still true.
Sure.
Right. They're both collections of stories, but all of these things are written within a cultural context. In fact, it's been one of the great advancements of the late 20th and early 21st century with archaeology is we're uncovering far more about the surrounding cultures, some of the assumptions and worldviews of the people at the time. And it allows us to better understand what they're saying. I know someone's out there like, but why isn't he talking about the unicorns that are mentioned in the Bible? So I can do that just real quick. It's actually very, very quick. It's a simple answer. The reason is because the unicorns that are mentioned are actually rhinoceros, or there's several references to them, but they are rhinoceri. And the reason the word unicorn shows up in the Bible, because the Hebrew is rahim, right? And the thing is, it's a word that kind of, they don't really know what it meant anymore. So we have to remember, language grows and evolves over time. All languages do. And as you lose contact with some things, you know, words will take on different uses. When it was translated for the Septuagint from Hebrew into Greek, they had to find a Greek word for rahim. And they kind of looked at it and said, what's the best word here? Well, the word unicorn is basically what was used. Well, because we kind of have to go back, Pliny, I think it was Pliny the Elder, it goes back a ways. Essentially, the Greeks got the word from encounters with either an Elasmotherium, surviving Elasmotherium, that was somewhere around Persia and the Indian subcontinent, or it's just the Indian rhinoceros, right? The one-horned Indian rhinoceros. However you want to interpret it, that's where that word sort of comes from. If you actually read the description, it's like, you know what? It does kind of look very, very similar to, more like an Elasmotherium, which is the giant woolly rhinoceros, than say an Indian rhinoceros. But again, it's really neither here nor there. That was the word. That was the closest thing they had in the Greek. So that's what they used.
Yeah,
and so even today, the Latin name for for rhinoceros is unicornis, right?
Yeah.
So it's like it's one of the things where the idea of what we think a unicorn is basically just because people were hearing, they were trying to translate these Greek words, and they were translating them accurately. But the problem is how we assumed they looked, right?
Yeah.
Based off of descriptions, because a lot of these Europeans, they'd never seen anything like this. They didn't. Well, they had no context for it, so it creates a confusion.
Well, and it's a hard conversation for a lot of people, but it's hard to take something like the King James Bible and read it literally, mainly because of the fact that yes, it was not translated from the original Hebrew. It was translated from Latin, which was translated from Greek, which was translated from Hebrew. And it was the same thing with the New Testament, where instead of the actual Aramaic, it was the Greek version into the Latin, into the court form of English. So, you end up with the situation like what you're talking about, where the literal mistranslation in most Bibles to unicorn is there because, well, that's the version of the Bible that was reprinted the most.
Well, and the thing is, it's not even a mistranslation. It's a misunderstanding from our part, because we hear the word unicorn and we imagine this dancing, horse, right? And that's not even what was described. It's not even what the word meant.
Yeah.
It was because these Europeans didn't understand what a unicorn was. They just worked off of these descriptions from the Greek and said, okay, well, this is what we think it looked like.
Exactly.
Because they had never actually seen one. The word cockatrice also shows up in the 1611. Well, that's just essentially their word for a cobra. But the problem is things get mythicized. So it's not that the words were incorrect. It's that our understanding of the word was incorrect.
Yes.
Which, when it comes to 1611. Now, that having been said, one tiny little modification to the chain of events for how they got to where they were. So the 1611 was actually translated from Latin, but they did use, they had Greek texts as well that they used. And then in the New Testament, the only book that is actually believed to have been written in Aramaic at the time, or the first draft,
yes,
was Matthew. Everything else is clearly written in Greek.
Yeah.
So, and we did have those, we did have access to that. And so we had actually, you know, a lot of these scholars still had access to the Greek versions, and even the Latin Vulgate, you know, he was working from both Hebrew and Greek as well. And Jerome was a bit, was, had fallen into, again, off topic, but yeah, he was with it. So it's like, there's work there to be done. But a lot of the issue is what we think a word means versus what the word really meant. But again, a lot of these are like in the animals, right? Which brings us back to the things like Behemoth and Leviathan. A lot of people have been said, well, they can't be dinosaurs because they're extinct, right? It's our presupposition is that these things are extinct, and therefore they can't be what the description makes it out to be. And so a lot of authors will look at something like, say, Isaiah and Psalms with Leviathan, where Leviathan does absolutely stand in for like Tiamat and Lotan, which are they're two different versions of the same idea. And even Lotan is where the word Leviathan comes from. It's Ugaritic, right? But the thing is, I would argue Leviathan, because and we see it today, we personify ideas with things that are tangible, right? We see this all throughout the Bible. That, you know, stars are personified as angels. I would argue that because Job goes into a lot of detail about Leviathan, this is a real thing that existed. And the thing is, that it was an animal so large and so dangerous that people couldn't contain it. And so it became the embodiment of this idea of Lotan, which would become Leviathan.
Yeah.
Which is the chaos dragon, right? It's Tiamat to the later Babylonians, but it's Lotan to the Ugaritic speaking peoples. And what it is, it's the chaos comp, right? It's a monster from the chaos comp stories. And so they personified this creature and said, they weren't saying that is literally the animal, but they're giving it that, they're using that animal as a personification of that idea. And that's what we see in Isaiah and we see in Psalms. But when it comes to Job, they're saying, no, that's a thing. That is the creature that exists. And it's used in that chain of order. Same thing with Behemoth.
Yeah.
Behemoth is described, like there is no way to look at the description and not come away with some kind of sauropod. And a lot of people say, well, what happens is the author is going from normal animals to these divine beings, right? Behemoth is some people suggest that he's the bull of heaven. And then, of course, Leviathan is the chaos dragon. And it's like, but that breaks the chain of events, right? Because in this scene, God is talking about animals, and he's literally working. These are all literal animals, and they're just going up this chain. And then the last two happen to be mythological beings. That doesn't make any sense, right? It's like the zodiac, the Chinese zodiac that has a dragon on it. All the other animals are real, but they just randomly picked some mythological creature. No, it's because these were real things that they encountered. Maybe they didn't see them every day, but they knew what they were, and so their integration is because they were real things. And not just mythological creatures that they're pulling out of their hat because they were primitive people, right? We have a lot of this is also, I think, due to our arrogance. Mm. We look back and say, well, those people lived 3,000 years. It's Bronze Age. They're just primitive people. I'm sorry. Those primitive people did a lot of amazing things.
Yeah, yeah.
People, you know, generations before them did even more amazing things. These were not stupid people. They were smart people. They were people that didn't have the same level of technological sophistication, sure. But they were smart people. In many ways, they were probably smarter than us. They knew what the real world was. They encountered the real world daily. They're describing creatures that they encountered, that they knew very well. And even if some of them had died out before the writings of certain texts, it doesn't mean that they didn't know that they were real. One of my theories is honestly a lot of what we call mythological creatures are just animals that have just gone, that, you know, are A, supposed to have been extinct, quote unquote, millions of years ago, did survive into the modern age. But during the last, the Maunders Minimum, I was about to say Ice Age, but that's not untrue. It's just most people think I'm thinking 13,000 years ago or whatever. But what I'm saying is the Maunder Minimum, right, which was the Middle Ages Ice Age.
Yep.
Started about 1,000 years ago. I would argue we're actually still coming out of it, really, if you look at it. But I would argue that global climate change wiped out a lot of these, you know, a lot of animals that were on the verge of extinction, why they were rare to begin with.
Sure.
And then they are gone. And so now all we have are people's stories of them. They didn't have a way of preserving them the way we do now. And so what we do is we hear their stories and we think, oh, that's so absurd. They couldn't possibly be anything real. And so we ignore when they say this was a real thing that we encountered, that we lived with, and we just chuck it out the window because our arrogance says, no, we know everything. Yeah. We understand the way the world is. They're just stupid, you know, Bronze Age people.
Well, and it's interesting that both of these occur in Job. Job is one of my favorite books of the Bible, just to go through and read, but also reference wise and just really odd reference wise, where you literally see this person, Job, who is not of the quote chosen people of God in the Old Testament sense. Yet still God is like, look at this guy. He loves me. And boom, up pops Satan in the middle of the heavenly court. Now, you know, by all accounts, and this is where I mentioned earlier, and it's interesting that we got into Job because, was it the plan? Because when you read accounts like Job, it certainly seems like that choice in the Garden of Eden was quite a plan. And literally a choice given to us because, yes, you can't just have puppets on strings. You have to allow for free will. But that means that you also have to set the play in motion for free will. You
right.
know?
Exactly. Yeah. The phrase not according to plan that I mentioned earlier is a turn of speech.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, to your point, it's like, well, this does look like it's more of a plan. Well, if you have an omniscient, all-powerful being that's outside of space and time, I don't think you can really surprise them with anything.
And there is no, you know, granted, maybe Exodus might get a bit more paranormal, but next to Exodus, I would have to put up Job, because you got angels popping up, you got like devils popping up and just giving people boils and plagues and knocking things out. You know, like it's wild and it's crazy. And to know that, yes, like you said, things like Behemoth, things like Leviathan, they were not talked about as though they were myth or as though they were just stories around a campfire. They were talked about as though they are.
Yes. They were assumed.
Yeah.
And it would make, and the thing is, the reason a lot of people sort of regard them as mythological or metaphorical is because they work from the assumption that they've been extinct for millions and millions of years. And I'm over here saying, then what am I doing with accounts of mosasaurs? What am I doing with stories of living sauropods? What are we doing with cave drawings and depictions of creatures they shouldn't have known about if these things had died, actually gone extinct when you claim. Back to this idea of something that seems ridiculous to us that we think has to be mythological, but was probably real. And it's a perfect example. It's a dragon or a type of dragon is called sometimes they're called cockatrix. Sometimes they're the cockatrix. Sorry. Unfortunately, too many words in my head at the moment. And sometimes they're depicted differently, but the cockatrice traditionally is depicted as a half chicken, half dragon creature, right? It has you know, like chicken wings, chicken head, but then it has the back legs of a dragon and a dragon's tail. We look at that and say, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. But let me ask you this. You're running around the, you know, the plains of Persia, right? You're somewhere around the Tigris River. You're a farmer trying to get by. And all of a sudden some, you know, these quote unquote dragons show up. We would today call them some kind of theropod. Let's say they were, a velociraptor. The velociraptors from Jurassic World and Jurassic Park are not actual velociraptors. They look more like Utah raptors. That's a whole other kettle of fish. But let's say something like, any kind of smaller theropod, like the Oviraptor, right? Actually had a beak. Like it had a full on beak, even had a head crest like a cassowary, right? But any kind of theropod will work. We now know they had feathers. So let's say you look up and you see something like an Oviraptor. It's got a beak. It's got, dragon-like legs, we would say almost reptilian-looking legs, reptilian-looking tail, but it's got feathers on it. It has, probably even the claws, there's feathers on it, like a little wing. And they're just running around doing whatever Oviraptors or whatever theropods are doing. What would you describe it as? How would you'd say it's a dragon that looked like it was part chicken? You're not saying it was a chicken, someone had cut off a chicken and put it on a dragon or anything. You're just saying that's the closest thing it looks like. So, now, for me, I'm trying to figure out, well, if these things didn't really exist, how in the world did these Bronze Age people and Middle Ages people know that theropods had feathers? We didn't know that until the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And it was still controversial. It's only been in the last really 20 years. Oh, my gosh, I just realized, the 90s is 30 years ago. But it's only been the last 20 years that idea was even accepted. They were still having, there were still legitimate arguments over whether or not things like Tyrannosaurus Rex was, and Velociraptors were more related to birds, or were they cold-blooded? And we think, oh, well, Jurassic Park said they were birds. Well, but that was the cutting edge of the time. People still, scholars still argue that they were cold-blooded up until the late 90s.
Yeah.
So it's like, how in the world did these people know what they were if we didn't? And it's because the obvious answer is because they encountered them. They saw them. They said, hey, this is a thing that's a thing.
Yeah.
And that goes on to, again, the behemoth, which I would argue is a sauropod, into the mosasaur that is the leviathan.
And even with that, salamanders, that kind of stuff, going into, like you said, river cryptids. Those were things talked about forever. So to look at something like Leviathan and think of it in those terms, not incredibly hard to believe.
Yeah.
Whenever you consider giant salamanders, things like that, salamanders that grew especially up to 10, 12 feet long. That kind of stuff. They were frequently talked about. They, so much so that they are actively featured in tarot cards. That's how deep into esoteric teaching the salamander goes. And the myths of the salamander and, the idea of the salamander being a creature of fire, breathing fire, stuff like that. It gave birth to most of the fire-breathing legends of dragons, because in most cultures across the world, when they talked about dragons were an element of the air. They did not breathe fire. Things like that. When you start talking about China, Asiatic countries, things like that. So it was really the crossing between those two. That came up with what we know today as the analog for dragon.
Oh, yeah. Our modern conception of dragons is entirely comprised of merging a lot of different mythology together and stories together.
Yeah.
It's one thing, again, you actually look at most of the ways dragons were depicted, again, before really the 17th, 18th century. they look oddly familiar to us. Here lie the descriptions. They seem really familiar. The Wyvern, again, is the best example, because the Wyvern, I would argue, was a pterosaur. It's very similar to the ones I saw.
Yep.
I think those have stayed around. I think they are the fiery flying serpents of Isaiah. I think they're the Wyverns of Europe. I would argue they're the Jersey Devil that was seen in the late 1800s and by dozens of people in broad daylight. They're seen today by myself and others here in Texas and Georgia and Oklahoma and really around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And it's easy to see, especially when one of the things that we bring up regularly is the fact of history being written by the victors.
Yes.
And the fact of histories are adopted. It just goes that way with just about any culture the world over. You pretty much allow people to practice what they do, and then you adopt some of their culture into your culture so that things go easier for a conquered people. You have less rebellions that way. The Romans never really forced Roman culture or gods on others, but they definitely went through and said, like, hey, look, that thing you got, check it out. We got a thing pretty similar. And being Catholic, definitely what we did. And whenever you look at stories like Beowulf, for instance, a prime example of the fact of Vikings did not write their stories down. They were like Native Americans. Their stories were passed down traditionally from house to house.
Yeah.
They were passed down by word, and it was not until Christian missionaries came there from the Holy Roman Empire and wrote their stories down. So what was changed? What is now different? And once again, that whole idea of turning a salamander into a scaled serpent and losing the wings from the wyvern, to become the leg dragon and the dragon of Revelation, the snake of and the serpent of the Book of Eden. So yeah, it's pretty simple to see a lot of that and to see the fact that many of these things have been changed over the years. The question is the commonalities and the similarities between them.
Right. And to understand everything in their cultural context also.
Sure.
I mean, that's because really a lot of these situations and issues aren't there. It's not even necessarily there is a deliberate desire to change or alter them. It's just one sure. culture looks at one thing one way, the other culture looks at something the other way. And so the problem is we're looking at it from the wrong perspective often, because we don't have the same assumptions or thoughts in our head that any culture's head that from the culture that originated it. And so it's even oftentimes less sinister. It's just people have different presuppositions, and you have to sort of understand the mindset and the assumptions of these other cultures to understand what they were saying. And then you can kind of say, oh, okay, I get what's happening here, right? They didn't mean this literally, or maybe this was meant literally. Maybe this word doesn't mean what we think it means, or even if it's the right word, the problem is our assumptions of what that word means.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And for us to have that assumption to begin with, that must be what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Because that is our frame of reference and our filter through which we see things and process information. And we really do have to remember that we process through the familiar. That's how we defend ourselves. You know, like you were saying earlier, just to loop it back to the pre-commercial conversation of almost that victim mentality, of having sympathy for the person who victimized you because, well, that's all they know. Trying to break that cycle of thought pattern to where you are willing to look at information in a different way and look at it outside of your own frame of reference. So, man, what a great conversation. Thank you so much, Jason, for taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to come on anytime. I love your show.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, one big question. When it comes to paranormal cryptids, because of course, like we said earlier, cryptids fall within that definition of paranormal. They are just not within the norm.
They do.
Do you think that there is a connection between what we know as paranormal, be it strange science, what have you, and cryptid creatures?
So that's a great question. And it's, to simplify, yes and no.
Okay.
And so, like all things, a lot of things kind of, you have to depend on what the definition of words are, right?
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of creatures that we consider to be cryptids that are clearly metaphysical, right? They have these, and so I'm still happy to call them cryptids, but I kind of like to distinguish between natural cryptids, meaning things that are, like, they're natural. They're physical beings that live, they breathe, they eat, they do all the things, you know, the same things your dog does, right? What they are just relic populations that we are unfamiliar with, or that we believe to be extinct 9 times out of 10, or we've just never encountered. Again, by never encountered, what I mean is unrecognized by the modern Western scientific viewpoint.
Yes.
So again, this would be like living pterosaurs, right? Great example of that. But then we have more metaphysical cryptids, right? These are creatures that are clearly, we see them as physical. Maybe they are physical. Maybe they're not sometimes, but that they clearly are exhibiting abilities that are not normal. They're not natural. Let's get rid of the word normal here. They're not natural. They are metaphysical, right? These are beings that are not living and breathing and eating and procreating the way your dog would, right? And I think one of the issues that we have also in this, and this goes back to the very, our pre-commercial conversation, is we often, because people don't want to hear from other opinions, we don't really look at all of the data enough to realize, hold on, maybe we're using the same name for different beings, right? We saw this very, almost in real time with the chupacabra. If you remember back to the 90s, the chupacabra had like four different types of things that people were calling chupacabra. But a lot of their depictions, they would put spines on them. It's like, so you're like, man, these are all wild creatures. But if you kind of take that step back, you're like, okay, well, hold on. The blue dog that we've seen that most people call the chupacabra, well, that's clearly part of the myth because people saw them, but they called them chupacabra. And then we have these other, creatures that look like the reverse-legged entities that are I mentioned in the book. They look even very alien. Then we go back to, if you read Nick Redfern's work on the subject,
yep.
He points out that some of the original depictions of the first guy who drew it, and that first encounter of the woman, what she did was the movie Species had just come out. She equated what she saw to Syl, the creature from that movie. So the artist drew spines on it because Syl had spines in the movie.
Yeah.
She didn't say that the creature looked like that. She was just using it as an analogy, sort of the same way the Jersey Devil was depicted by the artist working for that particular newspaper. He took the descriptions literally, but he didn't take them seriously.
Yeah.
And so it led to this. The problem is people were seeing different types of creatures and calling them by the same name. And so we saw that, sort of come together. Something very similar happens in my book when I'm exploring the theory of the tales of the goat man in and around the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So we see how folklore and stories get merged together to create sort of new ideas. One of the big things we talked about with Bigfoot on the Texas Front Porch channel, my favorite phrase is, we don't know what it is, so we don't know what it isn't. And so our working theory is this. There is, yes, Bigfoot is a real creature. It is a natural creature. We have physical evidence of it. The Sasquatch Alba Vernix is actually an amazing bit of technology that's or data that's starting to come out. Not too much can be said about it publicly yet. I don't have an inside track. I only know what's public about it. But it's basically the skin oils from these creatures that have been left on glass. People have started this. They've been able to start collecting it. And it's amazing what we're doing, and what's going to come out, I think, probably this year or next year, is it's going to be essentially definitive proof that this is a living species. Now, that having been said, there are lots of people who said, but, you know, what about all these people who have encounters or claim to have encounters where they're telepathic and they disappear and they're all these other things? Okay, I don't discount those stories. But what I do say is this. What if they're not talking about the same thing? Sure, they're using the same name, right? But if you were out camping, right, and you looked out of your tent, you saw a tall, dark figure with red glowing eyes, it gets called a Bigfoot. If you're in your home, in your bed, and you wake up and there's a tall, dark figure with red glowing eyes, it becomes a demon or a shadow person.
Yeah.
Same phenomena, same observable thing, different locations, and now it's called by two different names. I think there's a lot of cryptids, you know, things we call cryptids that are actually metaphysical. I think we're oftentimes everyone's trying to cram them into the same box. And we argue over this because what we're doing is we're cramming two different phenomena into the same box. And I'll even take it one step further. I'm becoming convinced that at least some of this metaphysical stuff wants us to think it's Bigfoot.
Yeah.
That it's hiding. It's using it as a disguise.
Mm.
So again, it's one of those things where are there things that are metaphysical? Absolutely. And it's kind of clear that it is absolutely real and people are having these contacts. Are we sometimes mislabeling them as Bigfoot or some of these other things? Probably. Is some of this metaphysical stuff going out of its way to be seen as Bigfoot? I think almost certainly. So it's a much more complicated Gordian knot that we're trying to untie. And the problem is we have the ape camp and we got the woo camp, which, by the way, if you're on the woo camp, can y'all come up with a different name? Only Ric Flair should be able to get away with saying that as an adult human. That's what I'm saying. But what we have is we've got,
that's as toned down as I can get it this close to a microphone.
Exactly. But I love the dedication to it. I'm just saying Ric Flair is the only adult human male who should ever be able to get away with saying that. So guys, come up with something new. Like, just please come up with something else. But my problem is we have everyone's fighting over the name Bigfoot. They're not actually saying, well let's look at the data. Well, let's look at what's happening.
And
they're honestly fighting over the name.
And once again, yes, just like people fight over UFO, it is unidentified. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
That's literally where it stops. It doesn't need to go further than unidentified, does it? Let's try to identify it. Like, it doesn't need to go any further than paranormal. It doesn't need to go any further than cryptid. It's cryptic. We don't know what it is, but there are stories about it, everything else, and obvious signs of its presence, so much so that actual scientists have said, wow, that's some odd stuff.
Exactly.
So,
and one more thing, while we're fighting over the names and stuff like this, this is the other thing. If there's one other thing I can say before we end on this subject is this. This is to everyone who's a researcher, or if you're just a layman or whatever, we have to stop fighting over what people say is seen and only start counting what people actually say they've seen.
Yes.
Because that is, again, I have this whole spiel about Metroplex Monsters, so hold on one second. Metroplex Monsters, Dallas Demon, Fort Worth Goatman, and Other Terrors of the Trinity River, available wherever fine books and trashy rags are sold. one of the things I talk about in the book is it becomes obvious that people, like, there's the lore around a place, and everyone says, well, this is what is said to have been seen. Great. That's one set of information. But when you look at what people who have actually been there, they've actually had encounters, and what they actually say happens are two different things. We need to get away, as researchers, from lore. I'm not saying lore isn't valuable, but we have to understand that it's folklore. And the problem with folklore is it's not precise. Let's take the folklore, let's set it there, let's look at it independently, but then let's say, okay, what do people actually encounter? What do they actually see? Where do they actually see it? And go by that. And when you start putting that those things together, you remove the lore and you look at what people are actually claiming. It's like, I'm this person. I have encountered this thing. This is what I saw. This is what I heard. This is what I felt. You know, then you start seeing that there are very different patterns.
And you know, the more disturbing thing, I think, than anything, Jason, which we've got to get you on about, because once again, I love demystifying these topics. Not that I am not heart of heart, soul of soul, believer of believers, but there is definitely some truth and a whole lot of about these topics, you know. And it is literally filtering through that you have to do, and that you have to be willing to do, and you do have to be willing to put some things aside and just go, hey, that's in the catch-all leather bin right now.
Right.
But, man, the one thing that you brought up tonight that I cannot think that I've heard anybody else say that we definitely need to do a whole show about is, what are these things if they're pretending to be Bigfoot? If they are actively using, like you're saying, in some paranormal way, our own psyche and our own psychic memory and our own historic memory of these critters to disguise themselves, then what the hell are they?
And that's an entire show unto itself.
Yeah, man. Oh, yeah. Like I just got chills, because it's one of those, like, you see these things in your backyard and everything else, and are they just walking in the guise of something else that, you know, yes, we, as with UFOs, as with ghost encounters, as people have continued to say, I hope that, I wish that, I want that I have this experience.
Yes.
So are we manifesting that? And if we are, and we are manifesting something else on the flip side, oh, goodness lordy, what is it? So we definitely need to have you back on to talk about that. Man.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Yeah, that's an entire conversation unto itself. Absolutely. I got some wild stories for you.
Now, before we let you go, it is time for shameless self-promotion. So let everybody know where they can go to buy your books, of course, other than the Curious Realm store, because we'll add them all there.
I appreciate that.
I know that you also have an upcoming appearance happening, very, very upcoming. So tell us everything about it.
So, I and the other members of the Texas Front Porch Channel will be at the Alabama Bigfoot Conference. It's June 10th and 11th, and I will be there. We will be speaking. You can come and talk to us and poke us with sticks, and we'll sign, you know, your books, your body parts, whatever you want. You can order your tickets online at BamaBigfootConference.com. That's BamaBigfootConference.com. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be there both days, and you can come and hang out and say howdy and yell at us and do whatever you want. It'll be a lot of fun. As far as my, again, outside of the, you know, the, your store, you can, all of my stuff's available on Amazon. In fact, most of my books are actually self-published, just because I don't like editors in general, but sure. Metroplex Monsters, you can find actually, basically anywhere, purely online. They, you know, it's, there were some printed, but I think most of them are only to be found sort of in and around the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So, you can find them on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. But if you want some of the other books, like I said, I got links on SierraPapers.com. They're all on Amazon. Some of them can even be printed off. I do have some books I'm working on. It's going to take a little bit, though, because I'm trying to do a comic strip as well. And I'm sort of playing with, it's called Chupi Rules. Like, actually, I really want to have the first stuff out this next week on again YouTube and TikTok, and it's literally about a restaurant called Mico Duel's Mexican Cantina and Sushi Bar. Chupi is the sort of the main character. He's a chupacabra, and essentially it is a restaurant that is frequented by cryptozoological animals and creatures and mythological creatures. So hilarity will ensue.
All right. Cannot wait to see it. Man, I love it whenever people have projects like that going on, because that is just a great new twist and a great way to bring things about. Reminds me of the old show, what was it, DC? It used to come on after Saturday Night Live. It was made by Jim Henson.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I forget the name of it, but that was good. Yes.
You know, brilliant stuff like that where you get to get the, because, you know, there are some interesting parts of all of these communities, much like there are some interesting parts of any political group, you know, or religiously affiliated group. Like, I'm a Knight of Columbus. There are some really interesting cats in the Knights of Columbus.
Yes, there are. That's one way of saying it, yes.
So I want to thank you very much for your time, for coming on, spending it with us, getting into these conversations. Cannot wait to have you on again. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online, checking out all of the amazing work of Jason, as well as his great book, Metroplex Monsters, stop on by, check out the Falk Monster Festival. We will be live out at the festival June 18th. Cannot wait to be there. Going to be super fun, folks. While we're there, we're going to be hanging out with Craig Woolheater, Daniel Allen Jones, some of our other guests who are going to be out there. Stop on by, check out Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is the website. You can find all of our social media stuff right down here in the widgets, everywhere you want to be. We're on the BitChute, we're on Clout Hub, we're on Rumble, Gab, MeWe, Minds, TuneIn, everywhere. Stop on by, check it out, CuriousRealm.com, CuriousRealm.com/live for all the live events. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content, or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.